Corey, I have a question for you.
Shoot.
Would that it twere so simple.
It is pretty simple.
It is, yeah. At the end of the day, it couldn't be more simple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially with a podcast like this, where we just talk about movies.
It just starts, and we say our thoughts.
Yeah, we say things, and then we're done, and we go do whatever else we do in our life.
Yeah, and then we come back and do it again.
Yeah. Everybody, welcome to another look. I'm Will.
I'm Corey.
We're here talking about Corey's pick for the week. Super exciting.
Yeah, it's the start of season three.
No, it...
new batch of episodes.
New episodes, not new movies.
Not new movies, no.
No, but old movies.
Older movies,
Some
are going to be pretty old.
Yeah. There was this customer at work that was like, this is a really old movie, and the movie was from 2017. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know what old is?
Oh, man. I'm excited for the pick.
No, it's super exciting. I feel like I should just give you the floor here to talk about, first off, what your pick is, but also your history with it and all that, the usual Another Look stuff, the spiel. Let me know what did we watch?
We watched 2016's The Coen Brothers' Hail Caesar.
Whoa.
Super cool movie about movies. Coen Brothers, they love movies.
It's about a lot of things. Like, movies is... was like really the base layer.
Yeah.
You know, that every Coen Brothers movie has like five layers to it.
Totally.
And this is the, like, the idea of it being like a Hollywood, not satire, but like a send up of, like, I guess the Hollywood production system in the 50s.
Yeah.
It starts that way. That's for sure. But it goes some wacky directions.
Yeah, there's some really interesting choices.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom had seen Alden Ehrenreich in something recently, like a show or a movie or something.
But it wasn't Oppenheimer.
It wasn't Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember him being in that.
He's the guy who is with Robert Downey Jr.'s character, with Strauss's character.
Oh, okay.
In like the room, like where they're talking about him getting appointed to the council.
Okay.
And he's the one that is kind of like our point of view, where we start by like kind of believing all of the things that Strauss says, and then by the end you're like, oh wait, this guy's full of shit. He tried to get he took Oppenheimer's clearance away. So like that, and then he has that line where he's like, were they really thinking about you, or were they just thinking about something more important or something like that? I'm paraphrasing the line, he's great in it. And he has this really funny thing in the bonus features on Oppenheimer where he says, it's so great when you don't have to fucking lie about this shit. It's insinuating that he's really proud of this movie and in past endeavors.
Yeah.
Like, Solo. Presumably Solo. I doubt he's talking about anything else, but who knows. You could tell he's very proud of being in a part of this movie.
That's cool.
A part of Oppenheimer. Yeah. So I'm sure he has nothing but good things to say about this too. He is fantastic here. But yeah, please continue. Your mom saw
something with him in it, and you know she loves Robert Downey Jr., so when she sees Oppenheimer, she's
oh my god, the combination of those two actors.
So yeah, she was really like, oh, he's great. And I was like, have you seen Hail Caesar? And she was like, nope. And I was like, oh, damn. You got a treat.
It's kind of, I think, his like definitive performance.
And it was one of his first roles. Or I mean, like a breakout role for sure.
Definitely the first time I saw him. Well, he was in, he's been in some Coppola films. He's in Twixt.
Oh.
Yeah. Which
I've seen the cover.
I highly recommend Twixt.
Cool. Yeah, I always saw that at I worked at Barnes & Noble in the music and DVD department. And I always remember seeing that cover.
Yeah.
Being like, ooh.
He plays France. A guy called his name in Twixt is Flamingo.
I love it.
It's pretty great.
He's a vampire?
Not well, he's like vaguely spiritual. He's okay. Like he's like this bad guy on like the bad side of town. Yeah. That like Bruce Dern, who's like the sheriff of this small town, is always upset by these like hooligans by the lake. This movie's awesome. I highly recommend, if anyone listening, watch Twixt. Sweet. It has a new cut that Coppola put out, and it's called Betwixt Now and Sunrise or something like that. And
crazy.
It's full of like impressionist imagery and like very digital. Like if you watch Twin Peaks: The Return, it has a similar kind of uncanny vibe throughout. Oh,
sweet.
Did your mom watch Cocaine Bear? Is that where she
did
saw?
Actually? I think
he's
she
in
did.
That.
Maybe
that has to be the
maybe
movie.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
Because I'm looking at like what else is out there. Like I don't think she watched Fair Play, or did she?
Maybe. What's that?
It's a movie with Phoebe Devner and Eddie Marzin. It's
that means nothing.
It came out on Netflix in January, so maybe of 2023.
Okay, maybe.
So not this past January, but January before.
Yeah, it could be.
It's a psychological thriller type thing, but he was in that.
That it could be that. Yeah.
Maybe I should give that a watch.
I'll have to ask her later. She and my brother and I are going to watch Hail Caesar after we record this podcast.
You're just living in the movie,
dude,
which is
I'm
great.
Loving it.
But which is, it's funny. There's a lot of coincidences here because we just last night we went and saw Dune 2 together.
Yeah,
70mm.
The Way of Sand.
The Way of the Way of a Lack of Water.
Yeah.
but Josh Brolin.
Yes,
is in that in a key supporting role.
Yeah,
and he is the lead of Hail Caesar. So like we're surrounded by remnants of Hail Caesar, of people.
Yeah,
of people in the space who were a part of this great movie.
Yeah,
Also, so was that partially the reason why like it's in your mind and you wanted to show it to us and talk about it on the pod?
For sure, it was definitely. In my list of contenders, and I have like an evolving list of stuff where I'm like thinking, ooh, remember that? Like, I remember liking that 10 years ago. Let's watch that.
Yeah.
I did have a different pick selected for like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like the night before, I was like, you know what? I was talking about the Coen brothers with another friend, and like, I was just like, Hail Caesar is like, I think deserves another look. And I think it's a good season opener too, because I remember there being some divisiveness toward it critically, which is, you know, I can see some of their movies are not the best, you know?
Yeah.
Some of their movies are absolute masterpieces.
Yeah.
But this one, the first time I saw it, I enjoyed it. I watched it at home, so I didn't really know about the buzz of it or anything. It was just one of those sneaky Coen brothers movies that was out that passed me by a little bit, and then now I'm just sitting there like, oh shit, I can watch it on HBO right here, like,
yeah,
new Coen brothers movie, I'm just gonna, yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah,
you know, I feel like that happens with them for being one of like my top draws. I feel like I want to put them in like my top three filmmakers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they have such great movies, wide variety, and anytime they come out with something, I'm just like, don't care what it is, even if it sucks, I want to see it, because like it probably won't.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Killers. That was another thing in my history of liking the Coen brothers, was I saw that movie in the theaters. My brother and I went. It was fine.
Yeah.
There was another movie. There's a Woody Allen movie, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
Yeah.
Kind of has a similar feel. I remember kind of linking the two in a way, because it's like...
Like just...
Crime, like, caper, sort of offbeat.
Some sort of like... Yeah, like a mix of noir, neo-noir and comedy and stuff like that.
I don't know if it's around the same, if they were around the same time, but...
God, I always forget Tom Hanks is in that, and also Marlon Wayans is in it.
Yeah, I didn't remember
that. I should rewatch it. I definitely, from what I remember, I don't remember really liking it.
Yeah, I remember it being average, you know, and then I remember saying, like, man, I love everything that the Coen brothers do. They just don't miss, you know, way back in the day before I really knew.
Yeah.
And then a teacher of mine was like, Lady Killers. And I was like, oh, damn. Wait, they made that?
Yeah.
And I just remember being so surprised. And I think it was right on the cusp of, like, not knowing who they were, not really, mm-hmm. you know, being in tune with their, you know, their rise or whatever. Because, sure. I mean, I had seen Raising Arizona on, like, Comedy Central. I feel like it was mm-hmm. always on, like, with commercials, you know, you just, like,
yeah.
changing the channel. There's Nicolas Cage stealing some diapers, you know. It's like, oh, what's this weird movie, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, they just have so much once you, you know, like, The Big Lebowski, Fargo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, see those, I know, and then it's like, oh, damn, these guys, you know. And then the doors open, and you're like, oh, they made all these other movies, too,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, some of them aren't the best, you know, but...
I definitely wouldn't call them filmmakers that I count on every time and it being a slam dunk, but I do feel, since they've kind of gone and their separate ways and now they're working on their individual projects,
yeah.
I almost feel like I miss, for better or worse, what they were doing when they were together. It was like mm-hmm. it was even if it was a failure, it was a yeah. very unique kind of
mm-hmm.
of concoction, you know. Yeah. it was its own thing. I mean, not that Macbeth or Drive Away Dolls, which I recently saw, are like failures per se. I think they have their own merits. It just, they, I can tell that the ceiling and the floor isn't as, like, you know, the floor is really super low for yeah. them in terms of, like, what they're able to accomplish. Like, I feel like they know what they're doing, and there's a certain level of craft, even if the movie is kind of, like, not good.
Mm-hmm.
But then the ceiling is massive. Yeah. Like, they are so incredibly talented at making something good turn into something great. So...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what they're missing, like they're the bouncing energy, but mm-hmm. You know, it's up to them, whatever they're doing.
Yeah,
I really have nothing about, I know nothing about why they ended up separating yeah. for now. I think a lot of people have speculated, but I'm not sure if any news had came out. But if it's yeah. literally just I want to do different things, like, that's super cool.
Yeah,
that's fine.
And it reminds me of Oasis.
Yeah,
you know that band.
I literally have. I probably have heard a couple Oasis songs.
Oh, but dude, I bet you know more than you think.
I probably do, like, but I don't really know anything about them.
Yeah. So the Gallagher brothers, mm-hmm. Liam Gallagher and Noel Gallagher, mm-hmm. Famously bitter siblings, or, you know, sibling rivalry,
sure.
They split up to do their own stuff too,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like that's kind of great because you get double the output. You know, if you're an Oasis fan, you know, now you get two albums every year instead of just one of them together.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of think that similarly with the Coen brothers now. And it's still such a small sample size, you know,
because right.
aren't these their first forays into not working together?
Yeah.
Like, how long is this gonna last before they,
that's the thing, it could back. Be just like they each make one or two movies and then they're back together again.
Yeah. And then they split apart,
right?
And then,
I don't really know, you know, like, it's a very fleeting thing, relationships, and especially relationships yeah. between brothers, so mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that this, honestly, I'm surprised they worked together for as long as they did.
Yeah,
you know, especially two artists who are opinionated about everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the sense that it's more of a break than it is for creative inspiration and for trying something yeah. new.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if Joel would have been on board with making Drive Away Dolls, and, you mm-hmm. know, Drive Away Dolls is pretty, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a very just like goofy
mm-hmm.
kind of silly little romp, mm-hmm. Road trip sex romp type of movie, mm-hmm. very funny. Margaret Qualley's doing her best Nick Cage in Raising Arizona impression.
Yeah.
Like, it's that type of movie, but it also has like kind of a lightness to it that I feel like the Coen brothers didn't quite do. Like, there's always a darkness and kind of not a nihilism, but like a void of kind of existentialism in their movies that is not quite addressed in this, which is nice because, like, I didn't have to watch it and feel bad. I didn't have to watch this and be like, oh, God, like, that part actually hurt to watch.
They're just, like, so perplexing sometimes. Like,
And that's what, you know, kind of getting back to them as filmmakers and what Hail Caesar does really well. Like, all of their movies, I think, you know, a great majority of them, it's like there's that base layer of like the mix of genres or the type of movie they're making, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of that is what gets them the popularity. Like Big Lebowski, funny. Raising Arizona, funny. You know, these are great comedies first and foremost.
Yeah.
But then you kind of go under the surface and you start to uncover like how just unique they are and how strange they are.
Yeah.
Like the Hudsucker Proxy, like kind of like Brazil-esque, you know,
for sure,
about bureaucracy and capitalism and the being a cog in the machine. But then it kind of becomes this story about like autonomy and like what exactly you can do in your life if you set your mind to it, and the pros and cons of that. And there's so much to that movie, and that's like for every single one of their films.
Yeah, I love, like, when they get some magical realism in there. You know, they like the 40s and the, you know, the early stuff, like those fast-talking...
Screwball energy is for sure there.
Like that Jennifer Jason Leigh character in Hudsucker Proxy, you know, reminds me of the Tilda Swinton twins in... Hail Caesar.
They want the truth, Eddie.
Dora and Thessaly.
Yeah, I love them.
It's so funny. Like, I love when the first time you see her and she says, my sister, and you're kind of like, it's right out in the open. Like, this gag is about to happen. But even on these rewatches, I'm kind of just like, I do forget about some stuff. Even though I saw this a few years ago, and that's when I really had the greater appreciation for it. I look back on my letterbox from when I saw it in 2016, and I only rated it 3 stars, which I feel like is okay, but I'm kind of disappointed in myself now.
How dare you? Yeah.
This is no less than 5-star movie.
I will say, like, that's what this podcast is about, though. It's like, it's not just about us bringing something to the table that we want to have other people watch and we want to share in the conversation of underappreciated movies. We also want to be like, hey, I missed the boat on this, or this, you know, I watched this and I didn't quite grasp it. I didn't quite get it. Or I've really like warmed up to this, or, hey, it's not as good as I remember. It's like a, you know, taking another look at things forces us to evaluate kind of the ever changing nature of opinions and how fragile those are. But yeah, I was on board with this movie from day one, I will say.
Yeah, for sure. I remember liking it a lot. Maybe my rating was a bit more reserved because I was a little more serious about, you know, the 5-star. I feel like now I'm just giving them to everything.
That's the way to do it.
It does feel like the experience is a big part of why I'm giving something 5 stars too. Like, if I'm enjoying watching it, but it's not the best movie, I'll still be like, I loved that, 4.5 stars, you know?
Right, right.
But Hail Caesar, for sure, the last time I watched it, when we watched it, I was so jacked for it. Because I remember the last time being like, this movie is so fucking good. Like, why don't more people like it? I think it's so funny. And there's like so many themes. There's just so much going on. I can tell that there's like more than I can even comprehend.
It's one of their more dense movies, which is, you know, like we've been saying about the Coen brothers, like there's that initial surface level layer, and this is funny and and quick, and it moves from a lot of different gags and scenarios, and it's about Hollywood and the great beauty of the Hollywood machine, and in a lot of ways it almost is like you don't need to look below the surface here.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is on that surface level that is like, you know, skewering cinema and that stuff and the industry. You don't need to reach like too deep to get some commentary and stuff. And like the story's really tight. All the scenes are like, there's no fat. It feels like there's just, you know, it moves real quick.
Yeah, it's almost 2 hours, right? And it's like, honestly, it's it doesn't even feel, it's so quick.
Yeah.
Like it's very rewatchable. Like I watched it just last year. I showed it to Robin and she loved it. And it's, yeah, it's one that I'm like, even if you haven't seen it, it's fun to throw on because it's one that you can just put on to basically anybody and they'll get something out of it.
Yeah.
But I do think the Coen diehard fans find something pretty unique in it too.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of their best films, the more you watch it and the more you kind of become obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Is the way that you kind of almost see the real movie. You know, like The Big Lebowski, there's a fest for it every year.
Yeah.
And that's not just because the rug and the ferret and socialist, man, and all that stuff. Right. You know, it's not that. It's like, it's the texture of the movie. Like, that's why people keep coming back to it. Like, of course, all those things are important. But, like, my dad, he talked about for a long time. Like, that was his favorite movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, he said he saw it. And he like watched it and he thought it was kind of funny. And then he like left and he like went to his hotel because he would travel a lot. Mm-hmm. And he went to the hotel. And he was like, huh, kind of want to see that again.
Mm-hmm.
And he went back the next day and saw it again and laughed all the way through. And then from on, whenever he would put it on, like you heard that man laughing like upstairs or something, watching a movie, like 9 times out of 10, it was The Big Lebowski. And he was laughing at like it was the first time he'd ever seen it.
Yeah.
But it's just, that's how funny it is. And it's just like so well written that it just continues to give you the surprise like a unique way.
Yeah.
But that also, I think that goes to your point of watching Hail Caesar and being like, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
And then having it age, like,
yeah.
You know, it's not movies right now are all about the initial impression, like all about the initial reaction, the review embargo, everything dropping, people posting all their, you know, they got to see it early. They got to, you know, this is what the movie is. Get hyped. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie's out for the rest of time.
Yeah.
What do we do with that now after opening weekend? Like how, like when we return to this movie in 5 years, what do we think of it now as a thing? You know?
Yeah.
And I think they keep that in mind because when you watch movies of theirs, you're like, whoa, like this is aging tremendously.
Yeah. And the rewatchability with, you know, with the denseness of the themes of, like socialism and communism and religion, you know?
The religious element in this is really interesting. I wrote at the beginning that it starts with an image of the crucifixion before we join Josh Brolin's character in confession.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote that like the crucifixion here is when they show it, it's like oppressive looking. It's like kind of like it doesn't look like something that traditionally, I don't know, Catholics look at it as a sacrifice, as a image of mercy because you know someone was sacrificed for our sins or whatever. But in this movie it's like Josh Brolin's character doesn't really understand how to deal with that. I at least that's what I get when I'm watching this movie, because he goes to confession all the time. He doesn't understand the concept of, he doesn't believe almost in like his sins being wiped,
right?
Because the priest is like, in one of the best lines in the movie, he's like, son, it's really too much. It's been like 23 hours. Like it's, that hasn't even been a full 24-hour period and you're back again.
Later when I think it's in that scene where he's like the father's just like, do 5 Hail Marys or whatever. and Josh Brolin kind of reacts like, you know, he's like, okay, thanks for giving me that. But also it does feel like, is that enough? Or like, that's not really going to do anything to like absolve me.
Well, and like his central dilemma is really complicated. You have this guy who works essentially cleaning up Hollywood's dirty business. Like that's what he does here. You know, he likes to talk about how he preserves the magic of the motion pictures. But basically what he does is make sure that the image of the Hollywood studio stays as squeaky clean as possible, right? Mm-hmm, you know, him going to Scarlett Johansson's character and being like, how is the best way, you know, you're pregnant, we have to figure out the best way to make sure that, you know, this baby is not seen as something you had out of wedlock or whatever, mm-hmm. and all that mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, from Baird Whitlock's benders and all yeah. that stuff. You know, it's full of these wacky characters kind of essentially doing whatever. And mm-hmm. Josh Brolin's character, what is his name even? Did you write that down?
Oh, jeez.
I don't even know.
Damn.
I can look it up real quick. It's
so funny.
Because I just keep saying that, and I'm like, eh. Literally, the Eddie Mannix.
Yeah.
There we go.
Good.
Inspired by the career of Eddie Mannix, which is very interesting.
That's right, yeah. I remember seeing that. I didn't look too far into it, but he's a real guy.
Yeah, you know, he was a fixer, and there's, like, the sense of, you know, him trying to maintain the image and all that. But then you also have the central dilemma is that Lockheed Martin... Yeah. is after him for like a essentially some sort of, you know, a military industrial complex job yeah. working with hydrogen bombs and mm-hmm. and, you know, sneaky deals and mm-hmm. and something that would, I mean, the movie doesn't deny that he would be paid very handsomely for this job yeah. and his family like needs it and they want better hours. Like his wife is like, hey, like yeah. the hours are nice mm-hmm. but he feels the need to for like a spiritual need to be in this Hollywood space. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like, think what the movie is about. Like he's taking on the sins of everybody
else.
Dude, you know,
you're intelligent. I love analyzing movies and stuff with you.
But do you like see that in a sense of like,
I do now. Yeah. yeah. Especially with all like the religious stuff, you know, mm-hmm. Kind of like swarming, I was taking it more like face value of, you know, just like he, you know, is doing the thing that he loves doing mm-hmm. and it's comfortable, you know, and he's good at this, even though it's like a messy job, like that Lockheed guy. I kind of like how he's trying not to like shit on the movie industry every time they have a meeting, but he's basically just like, you know, he says like, you want to work for a business, not for a circus or whatever, you know?
Yeah, he says, like, serious business, serious people, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's this idea that, like, if he would take this job, he would, you know, develop into, like, a more, like, mature man or something of the mm-hmm. sort. Like, mm-hmm. like something mm-hmm. Like that his, you know, that he could aspire to be proud of. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get the sense that he's not really... Like he's proud of what he does at his job, but like maybe it's not something that is uniquely, I don't know, exciting or like something you put in bold letters on a resume, yeah, you know? Yeah. So it's like, you know, he lives a comfortable living, but there's a sense of wanting more, but he also doesn't know where he wants to take that more mm-hmm. from.
Mm-hmm.
Does he want it from religion? Does he want it from his family? Does he need a new job? Yeah. It's like all of this.
Yeah.
And it's also like working for Lockheed Martin would be miserable. And so I'm kind of like happy mm-hmm. that he stays where he yeah. is. But then I'm also like Hollywood. I wrote here that they're, you know, he's preying over two corporations of capitalism, like these two entities
sure. yeah.
that in different ways have their own dirty laundry.
Yeah. And I imagine he's going to have just as hard of a job at Lockheed and Martin as he would at Capitol Pictures, you know,
right.
like it's not going to be easier, mm-hmm. you know, it's just going to be like more mature, more adult.
Yeah. Something. Yeah. Like he's going to be like helping commit like war crimes
right.
as opposed to like, I don't know, covering up a drug bust of a celebrity or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, it's not so much like a moral struggle as it is a struggle of like, just indecisiveness. And mm-hmm. that's what makes the movie very interesting because yeah, you're cool. going from like all of these, I don't know, all of these like kind of wacky portraits of Hollywood life and Hollywood yeah. characters and people on the fringes in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, you kind of get a sense of like what the political and cultural like attributes were of the time.
Mm-hmm. In the very beginning when he like busts up that guy and the girl like doing a photo shoot for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of like Disney and Mickey Mouse, you know, where it's like, they're going to find anybody that's like infringing on this copyright.
Yeah.
We're going to find you and shut it down.
Yeah.
Like, even in your home
mm-hmm.
on like your sketch pad,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then with Scarlett Johansson, you know, the sort of like dual nature of, you know, what we see the stars, you know, how we perceive the stars and how they actually are.
Yeah.
In that whole like aquatic, you know, that scene with her, it's just like so beautiful, and it's really cool to watch the choreography. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to see how like movies were movies, or, you know, mm-hmm. I feel like Hail Caesar does a good job of showing newer filmgoers what older movies were like. You basically get a bunch of little old movies, mm-hmm. like old style movies, in this movie. Yep. And I heard, I was reading some criticisms of that it's like the vignette aspect of it doesn't ever grab onto like enough of its own story, or you know, the criticism of it being like too fractured into those little vignettes or something. And but
I can see that, but
yeah, it makes sense, but I just like that more about it.
I like how he doesn't really have an identity. So, like, the movies are his identity. So it's like you have all these little separate pieces that he's involved in, and, like, everything that comes out of that studio is, like, kind of a byproduct of what he is doing. Mm-hmm. You know, he's helping this film shoot, or this director needs this done. And it's like all of this keeps the gears running.
Yeah.
And keeps the pictures coming. You know, he's like very much responsible for like the constant doling out of the product. You know, without him, you know, second unit wouldn't get to the you know, the valley on time. And he you know, he calls someone else so they could pick up those shots, and so that movie's done by the end of the month instead of the beginning. And it's like, oh, like I understand why he likes doing what he does, is because he feels involved. But it also, like, what is he giving his all to, you know? Like, what is Hollywood in this movie?
Yeah, there's a lot of indictments about the industry in it, too. Like, for as much as the Coen brothers love movies, you know, I'm sure they're pouring their vitriol in there, too.
Yeah. Like, I to be honest, I think the tale of the Christ, the Hail Caesar, like the titular like movie here that we see a lot of with George Clooney and everybody, is, you know, Baird Whitlock is the star.
I love the
looks
names.
Terrible. Like, it looks so bad. It looks like something that would be on Easter weekend, and I would watch 10 minutes of it, and I would just like hate my life like watching it. You know, so like that's the kind of thing that. They don't need to say that. They can just show what it would look like and have your own opinions be made as to, like, this is what they're putting all their money into. This is their major picture. And that, but, like, that is what Hollywood was at the 50s, you know? Like, the Lockheed Martin guy brings this up. He's like, television sets, dude. And he's like, yeah, we like to think that families, you know, and it's like, it's funny, you know, movies under attack. It's very relevant, you know, to, like, why do we love movies, and what exactly are they bringing that's better than anything else?
Yeah.
Why should people go out and see movies?
Oh, did you see Mank?
Loved Mank.
You know, there's a line
which is a movie that grew on me for sure, I will say.
There's a line where the guy says, like, you know, about movies, like, it's the only industry where, like, the customer doesn't own the thing they buy. Or, you know, and I forget how he says it, but it's like a profound, like, oh shit, you're right. You're like, you're renting like a seat in a theater, or, you know, I think he says a thing about how like they still keep their product even though like we pay for it.
They can sell it back to you if you want to see it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you don't, like, all you get from film is memory that you watched it, an experience.
Yeah.
And, but that's enough for the human condition to be able to sell out shows of a new blockbuster.
Yeah, you know, I love the theater experience, like, for any movie, because it's, you hardly ever get to see it so big and so loud. And Dune is very big and very loud. And
one of the loudest movies ever.
Dude, I was like, loving it, though, but but it was making me like, this is a fucking theater experience.
Yeah.
You know, like... Even if we saw, like, a, you know, walk and talk drama, and be like, man, I love going to the theater. You know, like,
There is,
but then Dune is like, oh my god, I'm shaking in my seat because of the noise
and the bass. Yeah, dude. Well, definitely I think the cinematic experience is closely associated with spectacle. It's sure, you know, like the train coming out at the screen.
Oh my god,
I gotta get out of the theater.
That's gonna be one of my picks. We'll do an hour on
I think we could do it.
Yeah,
we could do it. Yeah. Why not? It'll be like our last episode.
Or make it
talk about that.
A triple feature of the people coming out of the factory,
yeah,
the
yeah,
train,
yeah,
you know, mm-hmm, like the first three movies
ever. Yeah. There is something about the cinema that connects to big, loud experiences, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this movie kind of, you know, it shows like all these little stories and all these different ideas that are coming out and how much work and effort goes into it for not that much gain, mm-hmm, at least for the people who are working on it.
Yeah.
Like you're a part of something, but like how much, you know, these movies aren't really treated as, you don't know if they're classics.
Dude.
You don't know if they're they in this universe, they will be seen as, you just know that they're one of many films that the studio mm-hmm is making.
I think about that all the time with like actors making movies right now.
Yeah.
You know, some of them I feel like when you're doing it, you have the feeling of like, this is going to be great. You know, like right. Dune was probably like, this is going to work, you know?
Yeah.
But then like Barbarian, for example, was, you know, in that beginning, you know, when she's at the house and you're kind of like, is this guy a creep? Like, what is going on? That mm-hmm whole part is just all dialogue. And, like, it's basically just, you know, it's just their acting. Mm-hmm. The camera angles work and the lighting, you know, is very moody. So it's, like, giving you the clues of, like, be freaked out about this, but you don't know why.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I just put myself in the scene of being like, okay, let's do another take of those lines. And it's just like, is this going to work? Like, is this going to be scary? Is the tension going to be there? Like,
the anxiety of putting a movie together, it's not just when you're writing the script, it's not just when you're editing the movie and trying to make sure that it all flows properly and the mm-hmm beats hit all in the right way. Mm-hmm. It's also like when you're on the day of the shoot and you're trying to figure out how exactly to frame this and what should the actor say when they mm-hmm walk, you know, into frame? Should they say anything at all? Like, mm-hmm, you know, there's so many little variances mm-hmm and tiny things that can be changed.
Yeah.
And so I like this movie as kind of like a snapshot in just the time of the Hollywood system. Yeah. You know, it's not really about what this movie will be eventually. Mm-hmm. It's about like the process of making it right now.
Yeah. I really like all the names that are dropped and like so the titles of movies. You know, just like lore. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, again, like Dune, it's like there's a lot to pick up on.
Yeah.
But they're not spending time trying to explain anything to you. Like a lot of these you know, like they mentioned Clark Gable, and he's real, but then there's so many other names, you know, that are like, is that name real? You know, and then when they mention some movie titles, I'm like, oh, is that a real movie? Or is that just made up for this movie? Like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just love that stuff. It's so cool. It feels so real.
I mean, a lot of it, I bet, is pulled from just popular Hollywood myth.
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of it wasn't ringing a bell. I'm no expert on 50s Hollywood, which, to be honest, is so full of movies. Like, you could probably never reach the end of, like, what they put out in that decade. Also, can you even see some of it? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of it that probably just isn't available now.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Even at that time. So,
You know, another thing about this movie being about movies, it gives the actors a chance to, like, really be acting. Or, you know, like, ham it up. Like, I think about the George Clooney, you know, his Baird Whitlock in those Hail Caesar takes that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just chewing it up, you know?
So good.
But I love that about, again, the layers of, you know, because then I'm always putting onto it, like, okay, George Clooney is an actor. Mm-hmm. And he's acting in a movie where he's playing an actor. And all of these actors are playing actors, most of them. Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm, Josh Brolin is just his character. but like Hobie Doyle, you know, Alden Ehrenreich is playing Hobie Doyle, mm-hmm. and Alden Ehrenreich is an actor playing an actor. And then in the, you know, it's like you have to be really good at a thing to try to fake being bad at it.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that always hits me in movies like this, you know, or when it's like, you know, stories about a great writer, but then you think, well, the writer of this movie had to write that great writer's writing, and if the original writer's not a great writer, you know, how am I going to believe that?
It's like it's just layers upon yeah. layers of make believe.
Mm-hmm. And I love like the parallels between Hobie Doyle and Baird Whitlock.
Totally,
because they're both like committed actors. One thing I picked up on that I really liked in the beginning, when you see Hobie Doyle for the first time, he's doing this handstand on a horse,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then after that he says to the director, asks him like, should I do that again? You know, I could do it better. Do you want another take? Mm-hmm. And then when we see Baird Whitlock, you know, for the first time, I'm pretty sure, like after the take we see, he says the same thing to the director. You know, he's yeah. like, should we do another one? You know, and they're like, oh, no, don't worry about it. And he's like, oh, okay, great. But just that they're both like, you know, they're taking it seriously, their job as actors, whether one's just like, you know, Hobie Doyle's no Baird Whitlock, you mm-hmm. know, but then even Baird Whitlock is like, is he good in this Hail Caesar? Or mm-hmm. like some of those takes, you know, when he's like seeing the Holy Spirit or whatever, mm-hmm. like look good.
Yeah.
No, but it's, then other it's... times he's really hamming it up.
It's funny how this it portrays directors of Westerns and directors of like costume epics mm-hmm. because like both of those films, the sets are very like, we got it. We got the shot.
Yeah.
I can do it again. Like I can try it a little different. Mm-hmm. We got it. Yeah. You know, like
yeah.
it's a machine. It's running the exact way like
yeah.
that it needs to. You have mm-hmm.
We're on the clock.
You have like his assistant come up to him and you know the script supervisor and is like, all right, for the next scene they changed ardor or they changed passion to ardor or something
yeah,
like that yep, and yep. he freaks out, he's like, I liked passion,
yeah,
but he doesn't say anything else to it because that's the script yeah. change, you know, mm-hmm. that's it. So it doesn't feel like improvisational, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of freedom in those sets versus like maybe you get a sense that Baird Whitlock wants that a little bit whereas Hobie Doyle is totally fine at just going and eating lunch. Mm-hmm. If the director mm-hmm. says it's good, the director says it's good. Yep. Why would I deny that?
Yep. Get his plate of beans.
Exactly. Get your plate of beans. But then in contrast to the director played by Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, my God.
Of a established producer, like almost like a David O. Selznick sure. type.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not quite sure what is the exact, like, real life mimic they're trying to go for there,
yeah,
but someone yeah. who is very much focused with the actor,
mm-hmm.
pulling out the best performance, discussing mm-hmm. the script, you know, proud of their work.
Yeah.
And he kind of comes off like, even as much as like Hobie Doyle in that great scene is not like
mm-hmm.
hitting the mark right.
Yeah.
He almost comes off a bit fussy, like you're doing too much here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm curious, like, cause I've heard that the Coen brothers are kind of like, they're like vague and they kind of just say okay. what they, you know, they say what they want to say to the actor.
Yeah.
And sometimes they say things that the actor might not even get and the actor works through it themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm generalizing. I'm sure there's
yeah,
actors have different experiences with them based on their familiarity and all that. But
yeah,
I've heard they're not like bring you to the side and like have a 20-minute conversation mm-hmm. about the character's motivation. Just mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. react differently. Or give me mm-hmm. give me something else there, you know, which is interesting to them watch this movie and you see their portrayal of Hollywood as something that yeah. is kind of hands off. Like, do they appreciate mm-hmm. that like yeah. as like as a mode of production, mm-hmm. something where they just like let everything kind of just run its course? Mm-hmm. You throw in your two cents here and there, but the movie's going to be the movie,
mm-hmm.
you know. Of course, when they're writing it, it's yeah. from the ground up. But Hollywood is interesting in that way where you can just kind of like let it run
mm-hmm.
and it'll just yeah. do its thing as long as you are like have everything like in its right place mm-hmm. and people are doing their jobs.
Yeah. And like the personality differences too with the directors, like with on Hail Caesar, I forget the guy's name, but the director, you know, just like squint at the grandeur, you know, like shouting all these directions. And then Ralph Fiennes is like a lot more gentle, especially with Hobie. Now that we're in this scene, I feel like maybe back up just a little bit, because they take Hobie Doyle, who's basically like a stuntman.
Yeah, he's a cowboy who is famous because of his stunts. You know, a cowboy actor, there were a lot of those at the time who cowboy was an easy way to put someone in, like with a pretty face or a pretty singing voice. You know, I think of like Ricky Nelson, someone who was a pop star turned actor. And you put them in a movie in a cowboy hat and a Western getup, and they look great, and they do their thing, you know. Yeah. So, like, he's very much mimicking that. And, yeah, he's asked to be a last-minute replacement in this extravagant costume picture.
Yeah, and they're changing his image. Like, the studio's going to change Hobie Doyle's image.
That is a great moment to bring up, because he's eating his beans and his roll at lunch, and this faceless person comes up out of camera, and they're like, we're going to need you to report to the set tomorrow morning or something like that. And he's like, oh, why? And they're like, we're changing your image.
Yeah.
And then he's like, okay. The studio's arranging it. You know, it's like it's like all of these, like, the studio, we're changing it. It's done. Yeah. Like, it's already decided. You're going to be doing that. And Hobie's like, sure, whatever. Like, it's a job.
Another layer of, like, the identity of the actor or whatever.
Like, right, like, what shifting. What exactly does the actor have here? You know, like, what are they actually bringing to the table if everything's prearranged? Contract actors, things like that. I mean, if they wanted to keep their job, they just did what they were told.
So it is interesting. Doyle gets cast in Lawrence.
There you go.
Forget the name of, what is the name of that movie that they're working on?
I can pull it up.
Look it up. Thank you. And such a funny name. Like, you know, word humor is like big for the Coen brothers. I feel like just dialogue in general. To go back to the Jennifer Jason Leigh, you know, Intolerable Cruelty, Cruelty. It's been a while since I've seen that. I remember liking it, but the thing that sticks with me about that movie is like the fast talking, that kind of 40s, like, you know, that kind of dialogue. There are a lot of words in this movie too, watching it with the subtitles. Dirndl, D-I-R-N-D-L, valise, V-A-L-I-S-E. So this scene that Hobie Doyle comes in on.
Children are coming home from school, and my dog Perry is letting everyone know that he sees them and he's excited about it.
Hobie Doyle comes into this scene, and it's like, it's like a ballroom.
I couldn't find the title anywhere, by the way. It's like not the Wikipedia page is so bare for this movie. It's like absolutely absurd.
He's in a tuxedo. He's got to walk across the floor and sit down and like make eye contact with the actress in the scene and return his line. And then he even says in the scene, like, oh, looking at another person and speaking when they're speaking to me, that's something different that I've never done, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, to go back to the point about you have to be good at something in order to be bad at it, like just him walking in the door of this scene and like messing up opening the door, you know, it's just like, it's just so perfect because it's like, it's just such a light touch with like, just mess this thing up, you know? But he has to be perfectly messing up his acting. You know what I mean? It's just like,
he has to deliver that like ineptitude in a convincing way.
I'm in this loop. I get in this loop in my head and kind of like Ladies Man, you know, that Jerry Lewis movie we watched last season. Like, I had a similar point, I think, in that when he's carrying that big bucket of water or milk or whatever.
Right.
You know, and it's like he has to be so good at like not spilling it, but just spilling it, you know?
Like, yeah, no, he's walking around and it's just like it's spilling a little bit at a time. Yeah. And you're just like, oh my God, like there's so many spills at this point, but it's still yeah. full,
yeah.
you know?
Oh man, but then this scene in Hail Caesar, you know, he's trying to deliver this line, would that it were so simple.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it's a hard line for him to say. And he doesn't usually speak a lot of lines. And then he's got this voice that's like, would that it were so simple.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he says it, and then everyone is just quiet on the set when he delivers the line, and it's really bad. And then Ralph Fiennes is so gentle to be like, good try. Yeah. Let's try, you know, try it like this. And then just when he's like telling him, you know, a mirthless chuckle.
Yeah, and it's like he looks at him like he goes, mirthless chuckle.
Yeah, he's like okay.
But like
he doesn't.
No, he has no yeah. idea what that means.
And then when he delivers that mirthless chuckle, again, like it's like, huh!
Yeah.
It's so bad.
It's
but it's so good, Alden Ehrenreich. You fucking destroy this scene. This scene, I think, is just like the best part of this movie. It's the part that I think about the most. It's so funny. I just love the dialogue. You know, just the difference in like in vernacular, you know?
Yeah.
Because Lorenz, or you know, just like, that's so funny. His name sound, both of his names sound the same. And then he's saying, Hobie Doyle calls him Lorenz.
Yeah. Because
that's his first name. Mm-hmm. And then he insists to be called Mr. Lorenz.
Until he is sick of him messing up. And then he's yeah. like, oh, just call me by my Christian name, boy. Lorenz is fine.
Yeah.
Because he's just like, God damn it, kid. So like, confusing. Just figuring it out.
And there's some other, you know, he has another rueful, you know, he has another direction that's like mm-hmm. a mirthless chuckle. You know, he's like more rueful or whatever. But, you yeah. know, he's saying, would that it were so simple, is like how Ralph Fiennes' his character pronounces it. And then Hobie Doyle's trying to just mimic that, mm-hmm. you know, because basically Mr. Lorenz gets to the point where he's just like, just say it how I say it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what's awesome? In the subtitles, they spell out twer. Would that it were so simple. TWUUUUUUH.
They did it perfect because that is twer.
And it's so funny where it's like, why are you saying twer?
What yeah, did you twer? Yeah, what do you. He's basically just like, what the fuck are you doing?
God damn it. It is so funny.
I will say, I said I wasn't going to bring this up in like any really significant way, but I will bring it up just as a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can shit talk this movie a little bit.
Yeah, let's hear it.
The movie Babylon, Damien Chazelle.
Okay. Didn't say it.
You know, big Hollywood epic, also kind of about the nature of Hollywood, but yeah. in the transition between silent to sound.
Oh, sounds interesting.
I think I'm sure you'd find some interest in it.
Yeah.
You love movies about movies. Yeah. That's pretty wild.
You did La La Land, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be like and fun Whiplash. And big.
Yeah. It's yeah. big. It's ambitious. I think it kind of completely flops. Like, it sure. just doesn't work. But,
interesting.
But
yeah.
there is interest there, for sure.
Yeah.
But there is a long scene where they're trying to use this very finicky sound machine to capture the sound, these microphones and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And Margot Robbie is, like, a young girl in college in this scene. She's playing, like, this college girl. Or, like, she's coming home or something like that. She
yeah.
gets into her yeah. dorm. I don't quite remember.
Yeah.
But she has to go in and open the door and hit a mark. And she has to say a line. And they do it over and over and over. And it becomes almost this comedy
mm-hmm.
of repetition because of how bad and how difficult it was with this initial technology that the studio was mandating.
Yeah.
That they needed to get done. Like, how difficult it was to make a movie in the initial period of the sound era.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. And that's like one of the better scenes in the movie. But that's also like a 10-minute sequence, maybe even longer. It feels mm-hmm. that long. It's very like an epic kind of set piece kind of the movie in comparison to this scene, mm-hmm. which is like 5 minutes
mm-hmm.
and it sells everything about like what Hollywood is,
yes.
which is like, redo that.
Mm-hmm.
Do it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how I want it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, let's just go back to the first way because that was probably the best one. I can cut around
feel,
that.
You can just feel that first time Hobie says his line. You can just feel everybody like, that's not good.
The cut to the crew is insane. Yes. They're trying so hard to be nice.
Yeah.
Or, like, to not show their emotions. Yeah. Right?
You just feel the silence and, like,
yeah,
everybody knowing, like, okay, yeah.
And then
Ralph Fiennes takes him aside and he gives him some direction. And again, he messes up coming through the door, you know, and, like, so I don't want to say what happens later with the payoff in case there's anybody who hasn't seen the movie yet.
Yeah.
But this scene is so great and so funny. But then there's a payoff later, you know, like that comes back. And then that for me just elevates like the whole movie, like that scene, the whole movie. And then just the rest of the movie is so well made and funny and there's great characters. And it's still like about this mystery, you know, which is like, you know, you mentioned something earlier that was making me think of that whole, the socialist or, you know, the communist group that kidnaps Baird Whitlock.
Right. Which we have, we haven't even gotten into that.
Yeah.
But that, there's so much to this movie.
So it's like, that's just part of the rewatchability of why it's so good.
Yes, totally. And like, I did want to bring up this quote that I found that was really interesting, and it maybe does give a little bit of evidence to kind of how we're talking about this. The Coens cited their own examples of subpar films and performances from the era that they saw as television reruns while growing up. That Touch of Mink from 1962 and Laurence Olivier co-starring with Charlton Heston in Khartoum of 1966. They said, we loved that stuff. We just didn't realize we were watching crap.
That's awesome.
And so it's interesting to think about that. Like, you're growing up consuming Hollywood, right? The still the prominent, like, I don't know, like, source of visual entertainment, right? And you don't understand what even it is. Like, you, as a kid, you don't really get that this is something that's disposable. Or the Hollywood studio viewed it as a notch in their quarterly earnings. They didn't really view it as any ambition to have art, you know?
Yeah, right.
And the Washington Post wrote that, you know, that Hollywood's golden age is heavily filtered by time. It's easy to look back at any part of the past and say, yeah, that's how it should be today. Hail Caesar uses the uniformly terrible fake movies within it to show that while we all remember stuff from 1946 like The Yearling and Notorious, it also gave us Tarzan and the Leopard Woman. So, like, it's true, though. It's like when you look at Hollywood as an industry and you have to look at one year, and you go to 1952 and you like look at a year and it's like, what was made? Of course we remember what's good. Casablanca was a B picture, like, at the time. It was meant to be like the second of a double bill. I don't even remember what the first movie of was.
Yeah.
But the fact that it caught on and lives on as like a definitive, like, you could put Casablanca next to movie in the dictionary with a picture of it and people would get it, you know, like that's kind of how big it is. So what is the Hollywood industry? I think that's kind of what they're like trying to kind of showcase a little bit here, is what exactly is it. And also it is true that the Wikipedia also brings up like how it is transitional, you know, they talk about how it's not just television, but it's also that vertical integration was going away. So you have all of, like, Paramount owning their own theaters or whatever and, like, being able to distribute everything. And these movies would get, you know, a six-week run because that's what Paramount says. You know, and all this, they couldn't – they lost control kind of their own, like, I don't know, their own means of production. So with that, there's a lot of understanding of, like, it's up to the audience to find out what they like, you know. Of course, that goes into the 60s and how the 60s collapsed, and then the 70s, and the artists were like, hey, this is what people are into. And the studios are like, just take the money and figure it out.
Yeah, Taxi Driver.
Yeah, exactly. Godfather.
Yeah.
Those are the only two movies of the 70s. You know, we don't need to bring up any others.
the whole, like, communist kidnapping
thing. Yeah.
You know, when they, well, you know, jumping even farther ahead, when they get to that submarine at the end, you know, I found that was kind of like, Well, evoking, like, you know, the Russian cinema, like Eisenstein or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. it definitely has a very clear style to it in the music, you know.
Yep.
But I was thinking, like, if that's, I mean, you know, mocking, like, the, all that, like, blacklisting or whatever is, like, is this... I'm sure there was some spies and shit going on. I don't know, like, a ton of that history.
Yeah.
But, like, is this how it felt back then? Or is, like, is this how the fear felt? You know, that, like...
Oh, just, like, the Red Scare in general?
Yeah, or, like, for movies and actors.
Actors and screenwriters,
like, yeah. Like, Channing Tatum, you know, he's in that great... dance musical number.
Oh my god, it's stunning. That to me is the scene of the movie. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the mm-hmm. with the detour mm-hmm. so simple. Mm-hmm. I love that. But yeah. That's the other scene, I guess. Yeah.
So many good scenes.
I mean, yeah, I forget the quote. I think it was Howard Hawks or somebody said something along the lines of, like, you know, a great movie is three good scenes and no bad ones or something like that.
That's awesome.
But, like, this movie has pretty much great scene after great scene and yeah. no bad scenes either.
Yeah.
But the oh my God, the stunning dance
yeah.
scene for the song No Dames.
Mm-hmm.
Channing Tatum, where are you? Like let's yeah. like I love his Magic Mike films. Mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. love him in
This Is the End.
Oh my god, that wasn't the one I was gonna bring up, but I love that you brought it up.
Yeah.
I don't know. I want him to be in a full, not like a Hamilton, talk rap, fucking musical. I don't want him in a modern musical. Yeah. I don't want him in those type of things. I want him in a Gene Kelly yeah. revival musical. Like yeah. he can do it. Clearly.
Yeah.
Like imagine him doing like a remake of The Pirate or something.
Mm.
You know, like I, studios, take my call, please.
Yeah. Send him an email.
No, exactly. Like I got a great idea. It's foolproof. People will see it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's something about how graceful he is in that yeah. scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course the twist that he is like kind of like, you know, he's modeled after I'm not sure what actors you'd say, like, yeah, Gene Kelly, maybe Tyrone Power,
sure,
like yeah, the yeah, actors yeah. like the hunks of that time,
yeah,
but like
turtleneck,
yeah, for sure. No like he has that vibe. But then yeah, for him, for the twist to be that he's kind of like the lead honcho in yeah. this communist sect in Hollywood is amazing and so good.
When they're on the boat and he's like God. Looking back,
that's
with those
so
like hair
fucking funny.
God, you know, just another like an actor just getting to have fun acting, you know. And it's just like, make it ridiculous because it's only gonna serve the purpose of like your character and just like the absurdity of this movie.
Yeah.
But like you know, my question was just like about, do you think that's what all the people were afraid of, that it's like, oh man, our actors who are, you know, have these communist ideologies or whatever, even if it's just them thinking of like, hey, wouldn't it be better if we all shared our resources or whatever, you know? But then it's like, you're on the blacklist because we think you're like part of a sleeper cell and you're mm-hmm. gonna meet a Russian sub in this lake like off the coast of California, you know. Or it wouldn't be a lake, but like, you know,
it kind
of felt like it was like a mocking, you know, mocking that whole era of it.
Totally. It absolutely is. And it's, I like the scene when Bear Whitlock gets picked up at the end by Hobie Doyle mm-hmm. and they're driving away and the cops speed by them and they're going to the house. Yeah. And it's, there's this idea of like, I don't know, that this, it's like the 60s were already happening, kind of. Mm-hmm. It's like especially mm-hmm. in yeah, like LA, yeah. there's this vibe of just paranoia. Yeah. But it was like, it wasn't so rampant. It was like controlled and concise, and anything that was like starting to blossom or burst, like this, you know, like this communist sect here, was like immediately shut down and in the yeah. papers and exposed completely. 'Cause like, that's what happens at the end of this.
Yeah.
I also don't like how Eddie Mannix, like he's the studio, like he's the studio fixer to the point where he slaps Baird Whitlock for basically speaking facts. He's like, you know, this is the thing. This is how they fucking control us. And this is the means of production to how they contribute to capitalism.
Yeah.
And Eddie Mannix is like, you're going to go there and be a movie star.
Yeah.
Read the scripts that we give you. Yeah. Act at the scenes that we want you to be at. And it's kind of, I don't know. That's a choice by the Coen brothers to have our lead character say that. And kind of settle back in. At the end, he's like taking like notes from his secretary, and you're like, this is what he's going to do for the rest of his life.
He says to Baird, like, after he slaps him and you know, lays the law down, he's like, hey, do a great job. Or, you know, like, be a great actor.
Yeah, he gives him a word of encouragement there. And it's like, it's interesting because...
Yeah. He slaps the woman in the beginning who's, like, in the house doing that, like, photo shoot. You know?
Any sort of, like, convergence or, like, disconnect from how the studio needs things operate and how people in the – being on the Hollywood payroll need to act.
Yeah.
He's saying no. He's basically – this is that one – it's, like, his burst of violence.
Yeah, and it's like awful when he hits the woman in the beginning.
Yeah.
But then it's like funny when he hits George Clooney later. Or, you know, I mean,
it's it's funny, but it's also.
He hits him a bunch more, too, than he hits the woman. And then again, George Clooney is like giving him the face of like, you know, whoa. But.
Yeah, I don't know what exactly that moment is. I find the moment kind of almost upsetting.
Yeah.
Because, like,
it is a little bit.
They give a lot of time to, like, the communist group.
Yeah.
Being really just chill, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know,
they're just writers.
No, exactly. They're writers just like wanting thinkers. To talk about, like, the, you know, fucking Marx, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so, like, it's fine. Like, let them do that.
And I like how they, like, brainwash Baird Whitlock, you know, and then, or like how he's learning stuff and how he seems like.
Why not?
Like, yeah, he's like, oh, he's like up for it. He kind of reminds me of Calculon from Futurama. Like, he's just like, you know, he knows he's like the big star.
Yeah.
But then also he's like kind of sucks about it, you know, but then like he's good. It's just like funny and he's very impressionable, you know, and
he was if to be fair, if Eddie Mannix hadn't like heard that, he probably would have gone out and started talking to everybody about it. You know, and he didn't seem like a guy who like realized that what he was saying was to the Hollywood system antagonizing and so like wrong, you know, to the mores of the time.
Yeah, because he's like, he's not too bright, you figure, you know.
He doesn't seem too bright. And it,
similar and, like to Hobie, you know.
Yeah.
But then Hobie, I like how he like becomes the hero, you know, because he earlier in the movie... He gives his belt to Eddie Mannix to more tightly wrap this briefcase of the money that's going to the communists who kidnapped Baird Whitlock.
Right.
And then later in the movie, Hobie spots the briefcase with his belt on it. And then he follows him and finds Baird and brings him back and like saves the day basically for Eddie. You know, and I like that Hobie's like a good dude, you know.
He is a good
even
dude.
Even if he's a little, you know, even if he's not as smart either. You know, just another parallel between the two of them as their characters that they're acting as, you know, that they're, like, not so bright, but they're also, you know, like, open to new stuff. And
I love how he talks about his change in image where, you know, someone brings up his new movie or, you know, and, like, what he's doing now, and he's like, well... They got me talking a lot.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just so good. Like, that's just like one of the best. There's a lot of good lines here. Lorenz or whatever.
Yeah. So funny.
When they talk, Eddie Mannix is like, hey, how's Hobie? He's like, he's game and gamey.
Yeah.
It's pretty, like, this is a wacky movie. It has, like, the tone of something like, kind of like Burn After Reading, like in terms of like the more overt like comedic element.
Yeah.
But then every so often, like we're talking about, it has this really complex vision of what Hollywood is.
Mm-hmm.
Like kind of pessimistic about Hollywood, but also like, I don't know, kind of like comfortable with it because it's always going to make entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, it's like whatever mm-hmm. this is and however it's run, at the end of the day, we're getting like entertainment out of it. You mm-hmm. know, it's like, mm-hmm. like I don't want them, I don't want to suggest that like what's happening here is like good by any means.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there
yeah.
is like a weird, like, it's okay. Like it, like yeah. it's the Dream Factory.
Right.
And maybe I'm just like being a little bit, I don't know, like reading into it too much. Mm-hmm. But it does seem kind of almost simplistic for the Coen brothers at the end. Like mm-hmm. the end with like going into the sky as like, mm-hmm. like, and with the Hail Caesar music playing, I'm mm-hmm. like, huh, it's kind of like a sweet ending, but I also like don't feel that great about it.
Yeah. That is interesting. Another complexity.
No, the movie is like when it ends, I'm not like, ah, that was a good time. Yeah. Like I'm kind of like weird.
Yeah.
And I mean, all of their movies, like the best ones are like that, where I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
That like I'm chewing this.
A Serious Man, I yeah, feel like is
totally,
you know,
totally
in just talking about Coen brothers for the last couple days. You
oh
know,
my God.
And
yeah.
just like how perplexing that movie is. And just like, yeah, it ends and you're like, and I love Burn After Reading too. Cause yeah, it's like, I love that. It's basically just like a middle finger to like the audience almost. Cause it's like, it's like you got invested or whatever. Maybe you didn't, but it's like, you know, you're watching this movie, you're seeing the characters, you're trying to figure out the mystery, you know, trying to connect all the dots or like, how are these paths converging, you know? And then it's like, it ends up just being like, oh, well, that was a clusterfuck or whatever J.K. Simmons says at the very end. You know, it's just like, it basically, if it was an equation, it would add up to zero.
Yeah.
You know, where it's
totally.
Like, and it's like, did I even watch anything? Or like, but then it's so funny because it's just kind of like, it's like nothing, basically. But
they kind of like, they like to make these movies where you're like, is that even anything?
Yeah.
And then you're like, whoa, it is. You know, like,
yeah,
I think the best representation of that is Fargo, because Fargo is this yeah. movie that in many ways is so simple and
yeah.
so about simple people,
mm-hmm.
about a situation that goes wrong.
Yeah.
But it's directed with such precision and photographed with such beauty by mm-hmm. Roger Deakins. We mm-hmm. of course mentioned how
oh my
gorgeous
God.
This movie looks.
Dude, there's this one shot of the interior of a car. It's like a steering wheel and you're kind of like looking underneath the top of the steering wheel at like the dashboard of this
yeah.
car or whatever.
Yeah. Stunning.
I was just blown away by that shot, like that mm-hmm. frame. And it's like, I think maybe you're seeing the radio. Or,
yeah.
you know, maybe that's the focus because you're hearing something or mm-hmm. something. But it's like, there's just this couple second shot, the interior of this car. And I was just like, my jaw dropped.
No, it's so like, gorgeous.
I love
Deakins' work. But like, yeah, like something like this or like something like Fargo, you're watching it and you're like, is that all it is? And then,
yeah.
but then you watch it again and again and you're mm-hmm. like, no. Like, there's so much
yeah.
to this, like,
yeah.
fundamentally, like, complex and, like, mulled
oh.
over and thought over.
You know, one part about Fargo that always perplexes me
mm-hmm.
is the scene when Frances McDormand goes to meet her, like, high school friend
yeah.
or whatever, and he lies about how his wife died. It's like, is he trying to, like, get sympathy from her to maybe, like...
He's like trying to be with her, right?
Yeah, yeah that's what I get the, you know, that he's trying to like be like, hey, feel sorry for me and maybe like we'll bang or something,
mm-hmm.
you know? But then it's like we never go back to that. And I don't think we ever, or like we learn that his wife is still alive, because I think later there's like a realization
mm-hmm.
where we connect back to that moment, and then it makes it even more like, what the fuck? Like, and why include that in the movie?
Yeah.
If it's like not really, it's just like an interesting flavor. And there's actually a scene in Hail Caesar that I had a similar feeling with.
Yeah.
With Frances McDormand, when you see her as like the editor.
Yeah.
I love that space.
Oh my
you know,
God.
It makes,
yeah, it's
who,
so
who's
good.
Scorsese's editor?
Thelma Schoonmaker. Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
I feel like I pronounced that wrong.
Schoonmaker, maybe.
Yeah, that's probably right.
It makes me think of her, you know, just mm-hmm. like in the dark room, just like this lady who's just like whipping all these films together,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, the real magician. Yeah.
But there's like, her scarf gets caught in the
editing bay,
when they're like watching some of the dailies or whatever, they're running through mm-hmm. some of the Hobie Doyle stuff mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, we're watching the film preview and yeah. then like it stops and burns away and you're like, what the fuck? And then we're Eddie Mannix and we see Frances McDormand is choking, you know, because her scarf got caught in like the reel.
Yeah.
And then he saves her by reversing it. And then she's just like, oh, I shouldn't wear scarves. And it's like funny. It's a funny gag, but it's like kind of unnecessary.
It like adds texture to the world, I think. Like, yeah. I kind of see what you mean by unnecessary. I don't know, for like their best films, stuff like that scene in Fargo, yeah. to me it's like not unnecessary because the movie itself is so purposeful.
Yeah.
It may perplex yeah. you, it may confuse you.
Yes.
But it's not something that's not meant to be there. Right. You know, it doesn't right. it's not like an assembly cut and it's 3.5 hours. You know, like yeah, they decided yeah, yeah. what to totally. Put in. But like with something like this, which is a little more vignette based,
yeah.
it is possible that maybe you don't, it's just not working. You know, it's like sure. it's just a scene that doesn't, like, to you, it just doesn't really click as being, like, something that is cohesive and part of it.
Yeah.
You could tell that they probably just, you know, Joel is Frances McDormand's husband, so yeah. they're together.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they're
that's
together, right. so yeah. It makes sense that, you know, to have her in there. It could for have sure, been just sure. like that, but it also could have some sort of significant... It's an addition to the texture, right?
And I mean, hey, make it make sense, you know? I mean, this is one of the best things about analysis in general. Is
yeah.
like, and movies and the subjectivity of art is like, you know, you can make it make sense.
Totally.
And you know, maybe it's something about the, like, the constrictive nature of, you know, like, the business or something. But I do remember just kind of being like, what? Like, weird choice, but also like
yeah
it makes sense that
this movie is full of strange choices. And
your final note,
my final note is literally in all capital letters, strange movie. Because it is, you know, it's like Inside Llewyn Davis,
sad,
horribly sad, beautiful, mm-hmm. like probably in my top three Coen Brother movies. Ooh, I would say but there's that entire section when he's on the road trip with John Goodman's character and Garrett Hunland, something like that, actor.
Okay, okay.
And you know, he like he's an addict, and he has that collapse in the bathroom, and then he ends up like getting out of the car after, like, you know, and then he like picks up another car and he like hits a cat. And he thinks, he's like, is it my cat?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then the cat, you know, kind of strolls away into the winter. And, you know, they throughout their career, they've gotten more and more bold at, like, having these moments that just really let you linger with what, like, what the fuck is this? Mm-hmm. Like, what is this detour?
Yeah, how does it connect?
Where am I going? And it's not even something that's necessarily, like I wouldn't say experimental. Like it's not like Lynch where it's like the colors change and all of a sudden there's something else in the room with you or something. Right. It's not like that. It's more of like what did this character just experience and mm-hmm. how is it related to the journey at hand?
Yeah. Such interesting stuff.
No, they're remarkable filmmakers, and this movie is full of strange choices.
Yeah.
But it's funny, it's light on its feet.
Yes.
It has a lot to say about Hollywood, and it has a very complex portrayal of what the system was at the time. And our lead character may just be a stooge of the Hollywood system.
Yeah.
He may not be anything else than that. You know, there's layers to his character, but at the end of the day, he's just someone who wants to work for the big corporation that pays him.
Yeah. I really like about Eddie Mannix that he remembers everything so well.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, there's the scene when he's, like, at home eating dinner.
Yep.
And he's, like, asking about, you know, his son and the soccer practice or football or something. You know, there's uh-huh. something he was going to call the coach, but then he didn't get time to do that. But then the thing just worked out on its own.
Yeah.
But, you know.
That's a key thing, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like, worked out on its own.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's a guy who feels like everything needs his input.
I kind of expect more things to work out on their own, or for him to say that again about some of the stuff near the end, but then like none of it does because he's like in control of it. But but I was just impressed. And again, it's like, it's how the character was written. So I'm not like, oh, wow, look at this thing that this real person did. But just the way that he's always like, he's remembering stuff about his personal life. You know, he doesn't leave anybody behind. He remembers about everybody else's personal lives. Yeah. I mean, because that's like the thing he has to be on about. But then the production and productions of other things. And, you know, he suggests like renaming something one time, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, and then, yeah, when it's raining, you know, I'm kind of jumping all over the place. But just he's like so he is in control.
And he knows exactly what to do at all moments.
Like everything. He never forgets anything or like missteps, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah, but there is that sense, though, of like if he's so good at this, why does he feel like this need to do something else? Mm-hmm. Or why does he feel this need to change himself? And then it comes back to is like, is the work something that's morally fulfilling? Mm-hmm. It is kind of a question of like, what do we do under capitalism that gives us fulfillment?
Damn.
I don't know. Like, you think like that might be too much for a movie about like no dames or whatever, but there is something to this movie that lingers with me. And that's why I love it. I mean, this one's up there too for my favorite. You know, you make a top 10 Coen Brothers list, it's like mostly 5-star pictures.
Totally.
Like,
yeah.
You know, fucking No Country for Old Men. Oh my God. And sometimes I'm like, is that even in my top 5? Because, like, I love other movies more than No Country, but it's so, like, it's a perfect film.
I love it so much, yeah. And True Grit.
Oh my God.
Ah, that one's so good.
I haven't watched it. True Grit, I haven't seen in a long time. No Country, I haven't seen in a long time. Fargo, I haven't seen in a while. I should watch some of the heavy hitters again.
I'm in for a Coen Brothers review.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm excited to rewatch Hail Caesar in just a few hours with my family because I'm just really excited to, like, to dig into it more.
Yeah.
And to just have more experience with the visuals and the themes and, like, the scenes and how they, you know, kind of rearranging the puzzle to, like, make newer insights about it, you know?
Totally.
Like, I need to see it more times than I have still to really, like, grasp what's going on. And I'm just, like, so excited to do that because it's such a breezy watch.
Yeah. It is. It's a very accessible movie. Like, I feel like all Coen Brother movies are. You have to enjoy film on some level to watch them, but that's really a low barrier for entry.
Yeah.
And once you start watching them, you kind of just get lost in just how much they reveal themselves over time. So I think that's what I love about them. I mean, Corey, would you give this another look?
Dude.
Of course.
I absolutely. I'm about to. I'm about to
watch it. You're literally about to watch it again.
I'm going to go watch it again.
Yeah. but Corey, I mean, do you have anything else to say or are we?
No, I think that's
until think the that's it. Hail Caesar Part 2 review.
Oh my God.
Imagine. I mean, honestly, I probably could talk about this more. I'm looking at my notes and I'm like, wow, there's a lot of things I didn't even bring up.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
that's okay. Time is fleeting and
yeah.
all the scenes where he looks at his watch.
Yeah.
On a schedule. We're on a schedule.
And it's like one... No, I think it's over the course of a few days.
It does... It has that, like, that quick feeling of, like, wow, I'm with this guy on, like, his job, and it really doesn't stop.
Yeah, it feels like it's a 24-hour... That'd be another interesting thing to track, is, like, what is the timeline, actually?
And also, like, when he goes home and, like, eats dinner with his wife, and she, like, reheats the food for him, you're like, God, like, this is the one and only time we ever see her.
Yeah.
And it's like... This guy really is never home.
And then he, you know, in that scene, he's like, hey, what should I do? Should I take this job? And then she's like, well, you know, here's a pro about it, but also it's the 50s and you're the man and you know what's right.
Yeah, that's a weirdly written scene.
Yeah, it's so short and small.
Yeah.
Like, but
another scene that, like I said, complicates the entire picture.
So. Yeah.
But Corey, as always,
hell yeah, dude.
On-air handshake.
Yes, I love it. Great movie. Everybody, go watch it. It's really good.
And until next time, everybody, would that it were.
Would that it were so simple.
He's game and gamey.